Yo, my peoples, welcome to Rants and Randomness. I'm Lovey Ajayi, your side-eye sorceress, and this is my podcast where I'm talking about the things I'm loving, the things that I'm judging, and having great conversation with really, really great people. I'm here at the Chicago Recording Company, bringing y'all the radio voice, as always. And on this episode, I'm feeling good about Miley Teal's My Taught You Retreat. I'm ranting about how it's important for us to work just as hard for Black women and our friends. And I'm spotlighting the Do Better Academy, which is my online school where I teach people how to do better in professional and business ways. My interview is with Ruth Carter, costume designer extraordinaire, legendary costume designer. So let's jump in. It's going to be a good episode. Yo, I'm feeling so good about all the Noir Pixie Dust goodness that I was sprinkled in and sprinkled on by my fellow boss. This is at my leaks, My Taught You Retreat in Cancun, Mexico. Yo, it was popping. So My Leak Teal is the founder of a company called Curlbox, the subscription company that makes sure they send products to help Black women's hair every month. So My Leak was also the second guest ever on Rants and Randomness. She's a good friend of mine. And last year, she started doing this retreat to create a luxury event and luxury experience for Black women. They don't have to be bloggers. They don't have to be influencers. They don't have to work for themselves. Just Black women who have something of value to bring into a room. And it is bar none. It is bar none in terms of the events that I've gone to. I go to many events every year, like both luxury and non-luxury. And I have to say that My Leak's retreat, there is not one like it, because there's very few spaces that allow Black women to revel in really, really nice things. We're typically not in these spaces. We're typically not given access to the spaces where there is luxury. So for her to curate this space is so important. And she hired the Vanity Group, Carlene Roy, and her amazing team. Carlene was also a guest on my podcast, episode 24, to do it. And what Carlene specializes in is making dreams come true. What's amazing about the retreat is that the women there all come really open to learn, to empower each other, to be inspired, to have a good time. And over the weekend, what we did was, there was like a boat party with My Leak's name on it. Talk about a flex, okay? We just had a good time. DJ Olivia Dope gave us some good music. And it also happened to be a celebration of My Leak's 40th birthday. The retreat, I posted about it all over Instagram. You can go to my Instagram page. You'll see it under highlights, MTY Retreat. And I think it's really important for us to amplify things like that, because I wanted people to see what it was like when you gave yourself permission to have nice things, even if only for 4 days. Because I was a speaker, I ended up staying in a villa. And let me tell you, that villa was sick. I've never stayed in a villa before in my life. I had my own private pool. I had an outside shower, which I used 7 times, because I was just like, this is the bomb. And it's like, we just had one of those spots where it was like, I was constantly thankful that I was there, because something that I had done had put me in that room. So, yeah, it was just an amazing time. And we talked about squatting up, about the Black Girl Mafia, about the importance of what happens when boss Black women, women who are powerful, get together and show that we can absolutely rock with each other without problem. And one point that I wanted to make was that, you know, a lot of people were like, oh my God, I want to be a part of y'all squad. And I think it's really important that people understand that don't try to be a part of our squad. Build the squad with you, like with the people who are next to you. I've known My Leak for 7 years. You know, another squad member, Yvonne Orji, I've known her for 7 years. And the reason why we can rock with each other now is because we remember when the grind didn't come with no accolades and money, when we were just working hard because we knew we had a vision and a mission, and we was going to just see what happens. Squad up with the people next to you so y'all can all roll up together, and then you can form your fire squad. Yeah, man. Oh, and by the way, one of the mornings, Sarah Jakes Roberts actually opened it with a sunrise prayer as we all stood on the beach in all white. It recharged my spirit. It affirmed my soul. It was one of those things that I needed more than I even realized I needed. It was one of those experiences that let me know that I don't have to wait once a year to do really nice things for myself. And it also triggers my need to chase joy. This is the second MTY retreat. And like I said, while I was on stage there, it makes me pause and say, you know what? Life is more than the work. Life is also really about the play. And if we can play with the people we love, that's even better. So for y'all who were asking how to get more information on My Leaks Retreat, go to the website. It's mtyretreat.com. You know, apply, and hopefully you'll be there next year. And just look at people's Insta stories about it. Look at the hashtag mtyretreat and soak up some of the joy that we experienced there. So, yeah, I'm feeling good about that. Now, my rant this week is related to the MTY retreat, in that a big topic there was about how important it is to work just as hard for our friends or for young people or for Black women who are our bosses. This is important because one thing that, like a big narrative and a big idea that people don't realize they have, is that when they have a boss who's a Black woman, they really don't show up as they should, even if they're Black themselves. You know, oftentimes we also hold, you know, unconscious bias, even about our people. So a lot of us have experienced hiring people who talk a good game, and then on the job, you can tell they only bring their half game, and they'll show up late and not hold themselves accountable. They'll just do sloppy work and not worry about the fact that they did sloppy work. They're perfectly fine with it. But those same people will work for white men and white women and show up correct. Or if they make mistakes, they're instantly pressed to fix it. Carlene was the event producer for My Leak Retreat, and she made this point that I loved. She said, "Friends or not, when someone gives you an opportunity to work, you stick to your word, you show up, and you kill that shit. Let's stop the narrative that it is acceptable to be less professional when working with friends, a Black-owned business, a young CEO, or women alike. We don't deserve less, and we are stronger and more powerful as a unit." This is clutch, y'all. Like, as somebody who's a Black woman who is young and who's been running her own company, I know I've dealt with people who've just showed up in awful ways. And I always wonder, will they do this if I was not young, Black, or female? We take people who are familiar to us for granted in business, so we show up all half-assed. Like, you are absolutely disrespecting the person who is paying you for your job if you are just being an employee who does not live up to regular standards of business. And we have to look around and check ourselves when we are working for anybody, clients, friends, Black women. Like, I've had friends work with me and who showed up real sloppy, or they dropped major balls and felt no qualms about it. And in those moments, I'm always like, if I'm your friend, you should actually want to come even more correct, because you should have even more respect, and you should even want to root for me even more. So ultimately, it's huge. It's huge. And a lot of us insist on hiring other Black people. So if we're finding that people are showing up not correct for us as we're actively trying to do stuff for the culture, it's disappointing. And it makes it harder for us to build these, you know, noir pixie dust businesses if we constantly come across this type of behavior. Malik even said, "How are you going to have our Black girl mafia if you don't even respect your CEO who's paying you to do your job?" And that's real. We got to show up for each other. If you have a friend that you're working with, that does not mean you are giving her half what she should get. It does not mean you're not giving her a contract for your services. It does not mean that you can skip your regular processes and just be sloppy. Yo, do better. Do not take for granted whoever is paying you for your job. It does not matter if they're 24. It doesn't matter if they're Black. It doesn't matter if they're a woman. Do better for everybody. Because if you're going to show up for the white person in this way, why are you not showing up for your skin folk in this way? In fact, show up even better than you would. So, yeah, let's do better, y'all. Yo, my spotlight this week is the Do Better Academy. It is something I am really, really excited about, and it is my new venture. For years, I have been passionate about teaching people the things that I know. I've been a digital strategist for the last 10 years, and I've been a speaker for the last 9 years. And one of my gifts is my ability to relay big information in understandable bites to people in ways that allows them to connect. And as a speaker, I've gotten a chance to do some really amazing things. Like, of course, the biggest thing I'll say probably is one of my my TED Talks, my official TED Talk, Getting Comfortable with Being Uncomfortable, which now has 4 million views. Now, I've been thinking about this for such a long time, and I finally decided to make this happen because I feel like now is the time for people to understand that we have to be constant students in this world. As a speaker, as a strategist, in anything that I do, I always strive to get better. But not just that, I want to pass on information that I know to people so they can also find ways to make their dreams come true. So the Do Better Academy is a school that I'm launching, an online school that you can take from anywhere in the world that teaches people business development and career things and concrete takeaways that they can use starting today to better their professional lives. And the first class that I'm actually teaching for the Do Better Academy is one on public speaking. It's a public speaking masterclass where I'm going to teach people how to essentially write the talks that allow them to charge a lot of money. Because me being a Black girl who has built this career without any formal training, and I can command five figures for the jobs that I do, for the keynotes that I give, it's because I've gotten really good at just public speaking and just getting people information that hits and that's useful, that's valuable to them. So I'm spotlighting this to y'all because I really think you would love to be a part of this. It's going to be really valuable. Join the waiting list for the Do Better Academy at dobetteracademy.com. Go there, sign up. If you're on the waiting list, you're going to get the first dibs to the courses in the Do Better Academy, including this public speaking course, because I'm going to be limiting student enrollment. I want to make sure, especially with this first group of students that I have, that I'm able to pay a lot of attention to you, that I'm able to engage with you, and you'll be able to get feedback from me, from other students in the Do Better Academy. So join the waiting list, dobetteracademy.com. It's been a long time coming, and I'm so excited that it's finally here. Let's do it. I want to help more people in these rooms. Like, we often see classes from white men about how to become a speaker, but how does a Black girl do it? A Black girl who actually didn't have formal training and, you know, had now speaks all over the world. I just got back from Barcelona, Spain. I was in Dublin in March. So, yeah, join the Do Better Academy, and I hope to see you in there and come get this dope information. DoBetterAcademy.com. Ruth, this is Lovey.
Hi, Lovey. How are you?
I'm doing well. So first, I'll give people your bio because they know that you're epic, but you're super, super epic. Ruth E. Carter's unparalleled ability to develop an authentic story through costume and character has made her one of the most sought-after and renowned costume designers today. She's the 2019 Academy Award winner for Best Costume Design for her work on Black Panther, making history as the first African-American to win in that category. She's also garnered two additional Academy Award nominations for Spike Lee's Malcolm X and Steven Spielberg's Amistad, as well as an Emmy nomination for 2016 for the reboot of Roots, which was amazing. She's worked in the industry for over three decades and has been credited with over 40 films. And counting, collaborated with Spike Lee on over 10 films. Ruth, you received the Career Achievement Award in Excellence in Sci-Fi Fantasy Film from the Costume Designers Guild and the Critics' Choice Award for Best Costume Design. Thank you for being on Rants and Randomness. You're amazing.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Oh, my goodness. So first, I'd like to start by asking my guests, what did you want to be or do when you were growing up?
Actually, I wanted to be a dermatologist. You know, I spent a lot of time, like, steaming my face in the sink in the bathroom and sort of, like, going to my Mademoiselle magazine and, like, learning all those tips of, you know, keeping your face clean. And I just loved it. So my first thought was, I'm going to be a dermatologist.
And how old were you then?
Oh, I was probably 12, 13. But I remember that well. I perfected, you know, how to, you know, do a deep cleaning. And And so then from there, I thought, because I've been doing a lot of summer programs in the arts, you know, I grew up in the inner city of Springfield, Mass., and there were lots of college programs, Uhuru Sasa and Upward Bound. And I was, you know, a member of both of those programs. And they had black arts. They had African drumming, spoken word, which we just, you know, called it poetry reading. And I loved doing the spoken word. I loved the African dance and drumming. And so I then realized that, you know, I loved performing so much, I wanted to be an actress.
Mm.
But I felt that it wasn't an actual profession. I felt like it, you had to like pick, you know, doctor, lawyer, teacher, dentist kind of a thing. And so when I went to Hampton University, I majored in elementary education with a specialty in special ed.
Wait, so you went from, I want to be a dermatologist to then actress, yeah. And then you went to teacher.
Yes, to teaching. Well, I came from a legacy of teachers. My aunts and my great aunts were all teachers in the South. You know, that's part of our history and our legacy as African Americans. You know, we had to open the schools and mm-hmm. teach the children when others wouldn't educate us. We educated our own. And so because of that family legacy that I had, I decided to, you know, follow my mom's dream to study education.
And how did that go? What, did you end up getting your degree in education?
No, that didn't go that well. I found out early on that I was still in love with theater. Even at Hampton, I would audition and, you know, hang out with all the other theater students. And so about halfway through college, my junior year, I changed my major to speech and drama is what it was called, but it's theater arts.
Did you have the feeling that that was going to be the right thing for you? Or were you just like, I'll just try
it? Oh, it was the right thing. I had a lot of instructors that encouraged me, that felt that I had talent, that cast me. And I was Beneatha and A Raisin in the Sun. I was Alberta and Sigh of the Blind Pig. You know, I landed the part and I loved it. And I dedicated myself to studying my lines before everyone else and really, you know, giving it, you know, my full-on attention. And then there was a play that I actually didn't make the audition for, and the instructor asked me if I wanted to do the costumes for it.
And what play? Do you remember what play that was?
Yeah, it was Molière, The Would-Be Gentleman.
So
it was a Molière piece.
Ah, all right, so you had to do the costume for it. What was the learning curve?
The learning curve was, I went to the library, you know, way back when we would go to the library to research, and I got a book on costume design, and it kind of went through the steps. So I had, you know, dabbled in sewing in my room as a kid. I had an old sewing machine in my bedroom that was kind of like my desk. It was a real console type of a machine where you opened it up and you cranked the sewing machine up, and it became like this whole moment. So I taught myself how to sew, and I knew that. So I just didn't know the other parts. And what I discovered was through my library book that I had to illustrate the characters. And so I started to do that. And I also, you know, drew as a kid. I brothers that are artists, older brother who's a fine artist, and my closest brother to my age and I, we always drew all kinds of characters and we just had fun drawing. And so I was actually able to design the costumes like in a real pure way of textbook style, you know, draw the characters and then create, you know, what you have drawn.
It's almost like you already had all the tools to be this person.
Yeah, it was crazy. So I say this is like a sum of all of my parts, you know. And even the teaching part, I feel like is, you know, the education part has helped me, you know, in that I learned how to research. I learned about people, how to communicate with people. I mean, that's what teachers do.
So when you graduated from college, how did you then get your first gig? What was your first job?
When I graduated from college, I was a little afraid because I had taught myself costume design my last 2 years. I didn't really have an instructor that was expert at costume design. I really didn't have a mentor that could say, this costume design is correct. Mm-hmm. So I sought out internships, and I knew in theater they have some pretty intense internships out around the country. And there was one that happened to be in my hometown, Springfield, Mass. And I applied for it, and I got it. And it was a brand new theater in my hometown, and they rented out apartments across the street from the theater that were also brand new. I mean, the downtown area had gone through a reconstruction or, just an upgrade. So these apartments that they rented for the cast were also extended to the interns. And we doubled up in an apartment. So we have free housing. I applied for food stamps. And so I had free food and I didn't have to actually take an outside job. Plus, I was in my hometown, so I could drive to my mom's house and get my laundry done, if I needed
right.
to, or get a meal. So it was a pretty great internship that I had my own apartment, downtown. It was, in a nice new area, and I had an awesome internship. And that internship led me to a second one where I wanted to intern at one of the best internships in the country at the Santa Fe Opera in New Mexico. And the only way that you can be received there is by recommendation. And it just so happened that a woman who I was working for had been there, and she recommended me to go by sending a letter. And I was accepted, and I, went to AAA and got a triptych, which I don't think people know what that is, but it's like a map that they give you, and it outlines your driving path. And for me, it was from Massachusetts to New Mexico, so it was a pretty long drive. But I got in my Volkswagen Rabbit, and I drove across country and landed at the Santa Fe Opera and did another internship there.
Wow. And through all this, did your mom support your dream, or was she like, hey, what are you up to?
She supported me. She didn't understand what costume design was. I remember her attending one of the plays that I was involved with in my hometown. And because I was an intern, you had to, do all of the grunt work, So after the play, she was kind of waiting on me. And she was sitting in the costume shop while I was, collecting the laundry from the dressing rooms and sorting it and putting it in the washer. And I remember she said, "You mean to tell me you went to 4 years of college mm-hmm. to come back home and do laundry?" And I was like, "This is not laundry, Mother. These are costumes." But eventually she began to understand, my part, and she was always very supportive of me, always very loving towards me.
So it seems that every job that you got begot another job. What did you think made you stand out? Why were you essentially the person who somebody was like, "You know what? I have something else for you."
I think, there weren't very many black girls. I was that black girl that was doing costumes. And even at Hampton, there was nobody else really doing costumes. So I was very popular on campus as the costume designer. And as I, went from place to place, I still was the only black girl doing costumes. And I think that's kind of what made, the focus come upon me. And then there is the art that I was able to express whenever there was a special project, being some kind of beadwork or anything that required some artistic abilities. I was the first to volunteer, and I, loved it and could focus on it, and I think that others may have seen that.
I mean, it's clear that you stand out in the work that you do, and your first film doing costume design for was School Days, correct? By Spike Lee?
Yes.
How did you meet Spike Lee? How did that opportunity come about?
Well, Spike was a friend of my dear friend Robbie Reed here in Los Angeles, and I had moved to Los Angeles and had a studio apartment in Koreatown, and I was working at the Los Angeles Theater Center. I wasn't making a lot, but I still loved what I was doing, so I was there every day, and Robbie and I had went to Hampton together, and so she was my friend here, and through working freelance, I was the costume designer for a dance performance called Otis Ali's Night for Dancing, and it became a very popular show, and Robbie Reed was visited by Spike Lee, and she took him to see this show, and at intermission, she introduced him to me, and we all started hanging out, and he saw that, you know, I was the costume designer for this dance show. He saw I had my my portfolio with me at the time. And so he started to kind of, you know, tutor me on how to get more film experience. And he advised that I go to USC or UCLA and go to their film department and sign up to do to volunteer on a student thesis project. And I did. So before, not long after, I was on a set of a USC student on the weekend. Wow. And I remember thinking, you know, is that all there is? I actually didn't understand like the film medium, but I felt like I had been doing all of these, you know, big productions at the opera. We were doing The Tempest and The English Cat, and in theater, we were doing, you know, No Place to Be Somebody and, you know, Ain't Misbehavin'. And we were building costumes for these troops that were built from, you know, threads. And I saw this very simple scene that was being filmed. And it was two people, like, sitting, you know, out in a field. And I thought, they have on regular clothes. They're mm-hmm. not in big period pieces. I think I can do this.
And you did. So mm-hmm. when school days, what for school days, being on that first set, what was that learning curve like?
Well, Spike called me out of nowhere, you know, and asked me if I would do the costumes for school days. And I began sketching right away. That would say like it was in January, and we didn't really start prep until like the fall. I didn't realize the whole timeline and things. If people asked me to do something, I went right into it. So I actually went to my brother's studio in New Hampshire, and I spent time with him learning how to break down a script and how to do a budget. And, you know, he had never done a film before, but he saw that I had, you know, a script, a story. And, you know, he kind of guided me in that way by telling me to create file folders for each character, and anytime I had an idea, whether it's in a magazine or any kind of idea, that you would maybe write it down and put it in the folder under that character's name. And so I worked with him for a long time, doing all of the costumes, designing all of the costumes for every character. And then Spike called me to come to Brooklyn. He was in a little basement apartment in Brooklyn, and he said, you know, let's have a meeting about school day. So my brother packed up all of my drawings in New Hampshire, and I flew from Boston to New York, LaGuardia, and Spike gave me directions of how to get from the airport to Brooklyn on the train. And I did. I mean, I had no fear. I had no knowledge of any other way to do things but the way that I was being instructed. So I took the train from the airport. I got to Bed-Stuy, and I laid out all of these designs for Spike. And my brother said, have him sign the ones that he approved. Mm. My brother was working for, you know, IBM and other companies as a freelance artist in New Hampshire. And he kind of, he knew, like, the process, you know, his process. And so I had the sketches signed by Spike, and we took pictures and stuff. And then before long, I was on the set of school days. And it was really hard for me because it felt, you know, there were jigaboos and wannabes, and there were the gammites, you know, the gamma rays. There were a lot of us down there. We were all the same age. You know, we all had some kind of, you know, college experience. And, you know, there was a, like a rivalry between the jigaboos and the wannabes, you know, which kind of, you know, Spike set up. He had the dark skinned, kinky hair girl staying in a lesser hotel than the light skinned kind of, you know, girls with the longer hair. They were in a better hotel. So he set up.
Oh,
this
so
whole
he actually set it up behind the scenes also.
Yeah, he set it up behind the scenes as well.
Ah.
And yeah, so, you know, that kind of rivalry kind of extended itself into wardrobe, where, you know, they were conscious of, you know, getting good clothes now, and they were making sure that, you know, they had, you know, what they needed. And I mean, this is like 40 girls, you know, and I had to dress them all. So, you know, it actually was like one of my bigger projects, and it was the first project. So it was, you know, stressful in that way. I had to have something for everyone, and at the same time, you know, learn this medium and you know, be on schedule and on time.
So you were thrown into the deep end, essentially, with School Days.
Yes, I was. Yes, indeed.
And clearly you sink or swim, and you swam, because you end up doing, like, Do the Right Thing and House yeah. Party and Malcolm X and What's Love Got to Do yeah. with It. Your yeah. designs end up actually driving some piece of culture, because even now I'm going to a House Party-themed party in like 3 weeks, and I'm like, what am I going to wear? Now I got to watch the movie again.
Oh, you got to wear pajamas.
I got to. Oh, you know what? I already did the House Party one.
With, shorts with suspenders and like a crop top.
Yes. And I'm doing one. I think I'm going to a Do the Right Thing party. But essentially, the films that you've designed are still relevant today. How do you mm-hmm. approach your design when you are like, okay, I'm working on this film? What is the first thing that you do?
Well, the first thing I do is I understand the spirit of the film. If it's a comedy or if it's a dramatic piece, if it's significant and it, you know, it has a super deep meaning like the Black Panther does, I recognize that first. And, you know, by recognizing that, you know, it tells me what kind of approach I take to it, whether I take a, you know, more serious approach, or I can be lighthearted and look for, you know, colors and patterns that feel like they address the spirit of the film. And I'm motivated by that. I'm motivated by when I read it, what colors come to mind? What do I kind of see? Do I see a sunset? Do I see a bright sky? Do I see a party, you know, of color and pattern? Or do I see, you know, subdued tones? And I let that kind of emotion be the driving force to where I start with my research. And, you know, if it's contemporary, I start looking at, you know, contemporary things like, you know, today we've broadened our search to Instagram and Tumblr. But I also look at, you know, magazines. I'm online more now than I ever was, which is kind of great because I was collecting so many magazines in the past. But, you know, I start putting together files that sort of feel right. And I examine them and I make decisions whether or not I'm influenced by what other people are doing and addressing that topic, or is it a true, authentic addressing of the topic. So I usually lean into the authenticity, you know, and try to create my own aesthetic from there, you know. So if it's ancient African tribes, I'll look at the beauty of the antiquity and what the original heritage look like and glean from that. If it's something that's contemporary and I have to be inspired by something, I start from a shape that of clothing, you know, be it a big bomber jacket, some Missy Elliott.
Yes.
And, you know, I try not to copy it. I try to be inspired by it and, you know, start there, but then, you know, ultimately create a look that's unique to the story.
There's some films that you've done that are just really fun, like Baps and I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. How yeah. when it's that fun, like how do you approach that? Which one of those is actually one of your funnest?
Oh my God. They're equal, but I think okay, I'm Gonna Get You Sucker was my second film.
Yep.
And I remember Isaac Hayes and Jim Brown. I remember Jim Brown giving me a hard time because he didn't like to wear shoes. You know, I think through his athletic years, he messed up his feet and he couldn't, he just wanted to wear flip-flops in every scene. And I was like, oh man, you're killing me, you know? And I remember that the goldfish shoes, you know, happening. And Huggy Bear. And Huggy Bear was Antonio Fargas, who, you know, he had played a pimp a lot, you know, so he had pimp culture down. And then he saw that outfit and he was like, oh, you know, a pimp doesn't wear anything that big. I was like, yeah, but this is a gag.
Right.
You know, this is a gag. And so he, you know, gave it his best stride, and now it's like a classic.
I'm Gonna Get You Sucker as one of those films that I gotta watch like once a year just to laugh because the costuming adds extra to it. Just from the first scene of like the over gold.
The over gold. Oh my God. I remember bringing, making the t-shirt, the crew t-shirt, and I put the big gold, you know, hubcap on the front of it and had it lamed on the t-shirt with a big dookie chain. And I wore it to Brooklyn to Spike when we did Do the Right Thing right after that. He was like, I don't even want to see that.
I mean, some of these films are actually culture. And then, of course, Love and Basketball.
Yeah.
Sanaa Lathan, How Stella Got Her Groove Back. Your resume is literally like for the culture. It literally is like Ruth Carter has designed the culture. Do you sometimes watch the old films that you designed and think I should have done something different? Or are you, what do you think when you watch the old stuff?
You know, occasionally, like when I watch Thurgood, and I'll probably settle into it. You know, usually I settle into it and I'm like, hey, you know what? I did a good job back then. I was really working hard, you know, and so sometimes, you know, outside influences create an aesthetic or a look. And I, you know, I have to forgive myself if I feel like, you know, it could have been something different, but it wasn't. It was that. And then I get somebody who says, but I loved it, you know, and I go, okay, well, then I'm going to settle down on that. But when I look at Thurgood, sometimes I feel like the older Thurgood Marshall, who became the Supreme Court Justice, he pretty much was a simple guy. Mm-hmm. But the young Thurgood Marshall was the guy who really, you know, in the 40s, everybody was, you know, really, your mode of dress was so much a part of your identity. And guys were wearing, you know, those beautiful ties and shirts. And, you know, they had the wide leg pants with the narrow ankles. And they really liked to look sharp. And so I dressed Thurgood Marshall in that way, the way he was in the 40s. And I sometimes feel like it would have served the film a little bit better if I hadn't have done it that way, if I hadn't have made everyone look at the clothes and just simplified him. You know, he was a traveling attorney for the people. He went from place to place. He was in the South. He was on the train. He had one suitcase. Maybe, you know, one or two suits would have been enough, and maybe they could have been rumpled and really showed the true character of the man. So that's the only one I can really think of and say, if I would do it over again, that's the way I would approach it.
That's interesting. So how do you make sure you get better after being in this industry for, at this point, 30 years? What is your learning thing? How are you getting better every day?
You know, it's really getting harder because, you know, I'm not so much in the independent film sector, even though I still love it. You know, I did Black Panther and, you know, then I did Dolomite. And those are kind of big films, you know, studio films. And so, you know, I'm constantly challenging myself to stay grounded and stay true to my cultural base and be as authentic as I can with who I am, you know, and I'm always challenging, you know, aesthetics that are thrown at me, you know, because we can easily, you know, be spellbound by, you know, glossy things, Hollywood things, you know, hair and makeup and wardrobe and, you know, what designer is doing what and, you know, how cool this is. And I just want to remind myself that, you know, the way I got here was from grassroots, and it had an aesthetic that was, you know, real, that was about people and about their struggle. And I just want to remind myself of that on everything that I'm doing today.
Wow. So with this career, I think everything has a cost, of course. Like, what do you think is the cost of the work that you do every day?
The cost?
Yeah. Like, you know, you are basically designing blockbusters. What is mm-hmm. that process like for you as a person? Ruth, the actual mm-hmm. person, not just a designer.
Mm-hmm. It's laden with responsibility, not only to the craft, but also to my structure and how other people work. So I have to adjust sometimes to be able to do show and tells on a whim, to have appropriate crews that have the taste level or the experience level or a higher level of art. And, you know, people of color don't get a lot of opportunities to join the high level. And so I'm, you know, constantly challenged to mentor or, you know, find that gem who's out there who needs, like, this kind of opportunity. So it's a huge responsibility now that I'm here. And it's always been a responsibility that I stepped up to. I've always had interns. I've always, you know, been like the collector of the alley cats, you know, and I enjoyed it. Now I can't collect so many alley cats. I gotta, but, you know, I'll have one or two always.
So who did you, I know it was hard. Well, there was really not really many black costume designers for you to look to. I would say now you are amongst many, but you're still too few.
Too few.
So for the people who you do decide to mentee, what do you look for in them?
I look for the passion. You know, I look for the willingness. You know, I'm not asking you to do anything for free, but I am asking you I am looking to see if you're willing to stay late. You know, I'm looking to see if, you know, you are being analytical and not just being asked to being shown everything. And so I feel like I'm trying to tap into a little bit of the spirit that I had, you know, coming up, because I feel like that's really missing with a lot of people. They want to either, you know, walk in your shadow and, you know, have a good time and really not really learn, you know, about the craft. And this is really a craft you have to learn.
Yeah, I mean, the work that you do, you're essentially telling whole, building worlds with costume and clothes. And you are finally an Academy Award winner. How does that feel?
Woo, it feels great. It feels like, you know, I moved from the fifth floor to the penthouse.
Yes.
Yeah, and the building was always nice, but damn, the view in the penthouse is awesome.
And now you know there's a butler.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of amenities, you know. I'm weirded out a little bit because I go, you know, is this like a 15 minutes of fame kind of thing? And I go, no. I've been doing this a long time. But, you know, people are so enamored by, you know, the win of the Oscar. I mean, I have friends that come over and they want to take pictures with the Oscar. Everybody was there. I took pictures with Eddie Murphy holding my Oscar. And it was, you know, so that kind of like, it brings me a lot of pride and joy that people around the world cheered the night I won. And I'm being told that over and over again every day. And, you know, how happy people were for me and how proud they were. And, you know, I've been told to look at the video again, you know, when I won, to see the people in the room and their faces and how proud and excited they were for me, happy.
Has anything really, like, concretely changed since you won the Oscar about a month and a half ago?
A few things have changed. I'm getting a lot of opportunities outside of costume design, getting opportunities to be creative for a creative producer. You know, people want to see a Wakandan line of clothes.
Yes.
And, you know, so the offers are various, and that's kind of nice. I really love that.
That's interesting. So, well, let's talk about Black Panther, because I know people are always curious about that life-changing movie for a bunch of folks. You mm-hmm. were intentional about showing a... essentially what is kind of like our Garden of Eden, like what it would yeah. look like for us to dream up a world that was mm-hmm. just ours alone. When you got mm-hmm. that assignment, how did you approach costuming for Black Panther?
Well, you know, Ryan Coogler had a lot of really specific ideas about it. And so my first step was to be a good listener. Mm. He was the filmmaker. And, you know, I'm no good without him. You know, he can be good without me, because if his story is all that, you know, the costumes don't matter. Mm. So I had to be a good listener and follow his lead. And he was very specific about certain things, like the Lesotho blankets we used for the border tribe. He was very specific about the Dora Milaje being covered and flat split toe boots.
Yes.
He was very specific about, you know, how is T'Challa going to look when he's, you know, just being a man in the kingdom, just being, you know, a king or a prince. And so I just felt like from listening to him that the aesthetic had to be so high.
Yeah.
I also kind of keyed into, you know, what he told me about growing up in Oakland and his family and, you know, going to see Malcolm X, and I realized that, you know, the same things that were important to his family, his mom and dad, is the same things that I experienced as a kid growing up, you know, celebrating. We didn't celebrate Kwanzaa in my house specifically, but mm-hmm. my neighbors did. Mm-hmm. You know, the Muslims came to our door growing up selling, you know, whiting H&G and bean pies, and I knew all about the Nation of Islam. You know, that was part of our community. And I feel like his Oakland roots were similar in that African diaspora was, you know, alive, you know. And we knew about, you know, Marcus Garvey. And we knew about, you know, true African culture versus fake African culture. You know, we knew what fake kente was and what real kente was just by growing up, you know, with people who had that awareness of it. And so I realized very early on that was the ideals that I was tapping into. And I need to do this for the culture. You know, when you, you know, I grew up listening to Gil Scott-Heron and The Last Poets, the revolution will not be televised, the revolution will be live. And I felt like we were in a live revolution, and it was about showing the Tuareg and the Himba and really extracting the beauty of these ancient African tribes. And how do we reimagine this in a contemporary realm, in a futuristic realm? How do we bring that aesthetic so forward that everybody gets it?
Mm. It was gorgeous. Like, I felt like yeah. watching the film was a feast for my eyes. And you
yeah,
ended
was.
Up touching on every quadrant in the continent.
Yeah.
So can you walk us through, like, what quadrants you had for different tribes in Black yeah, Panther?
Wakanda was fictitiously situated right here in the northern middle section there of Africa. So it had the northern Africa, the Mali, and the Tuareg, and that represented our merchant tribe. And mm-hmm. so the way that the Tuareg people embraced silver and the Bedouin jewelry, that heavy silver, was something that I had actually seen in Africa going there on Malcolm X. So, and I bought a lot of Bedouin jewelry and beautiful aesthetic, and I felt like that was my vibranium.
Mm.
And that I could bring that element to the Tuareg the Tuareg people. Things kept changing, too, as we went along. Like, we'd have the Zulu tribe of South Africa as the tribe of the royal family. And then, you know, something would change and it wouldn't be that anymore. And so we'd have to sort of make adjustments. So a lot of the tribes that you see sometimes have a mixture, like the mining tribe was based on the Turkana, the Maasai, and the Himba. And, you know, the Himba of Ethiopia and how they use the red clay and the shea butter, and they put it all over their skin. And it's just like, you know, it's just beauty for them. It's like when we get up in the morning and we have to put our makeup on before we leave the house. Yep. For them, adding the shea butter and the clay soil and having that beautiful red tone is attractive. You know, people say that it was to ward off mosquitoes or to be sort of antiseptic during a drought, but no, it was pure beauty.
Yes.
And so we have our mining tribe elder with her Himba wig, and we use that red clay color as their color palette. And then you can travel to the Surma tribe, and they were of East Africa, and you see the River tribe. That's who we were inspired by to create the River tribe. That's Lupita Nyong'o's tribe. And they, the children, the Suri and the Surma children, wear the flowers. You see these beautiful photographs of them with the flowers and sticks in their hair, and then they paint their face, and, you know, really beautiful, beautiful images. And we're inspired by that to create her tribal look at the Warrior Falls, where she had her beads and her cowrie shells and all of that. And then you have her tribal elder, the River tribal elder, with the lip plate.
Yes.
And the lip plate is of the Surma people as well. And Ryan, usually the lip plate is worn by women. And, you know, the bigger the lip plate, the more beautiful you are. But Ryan wanted the River Tribe elder to wear the lip plate. So in tribal council, you see him sitting there in his lip plate. Wow. And, you know, that was a decision Ryan made. It was put on by the makeup department. And you know, he's sitting there proudly in his green suit. The green suit we got from Oswald Boateng in London.
His suits are crazy.
He also had a tribal suit that he designed. It had a tribal pattern on it, a beautifully woven tribal pattern on it. I couldn't get that, even though I really wanted that one. but I got the... he said it took 6 months to weave the fabric, so I didn't have that kind of time.
Oh.
So I bought his green suit off the rack and gave it to the tribal elder in that scene. And, you know, he wore it proudly.
The Dorma Lajes were actually almost revolutionary in the way they were positioned as powerful women without necessarily being objectified. Mm-hmm. So that costume with the leather and the red, what went into that?
Yes. Well, the Dorma Laje, for me, they represent all the quadrants around Africa, because you can from any tribe and be a Dora. Your head is shaven, and you kind of become the identity of the Dora uniform. And so what I did was I took the idea and I kind of gave it its story, you know. The red was intensified to be much more vibrant, so that when you saw three Dora, it felt like five, or five felt like 10. That intense red that you see a lot around the ancient African tribes of Africa, the Maasai, the Turkana, and so that was important. The wearing of the leather skirts was important. I was inspired by the Himba women, how they take the calfskin and they stretch the edges, they soap it down and they stretch it, and it sort of has a ruffling effect. And then they adorn it with metal trinkets and beads, and then they wrap it around their waist, and it kind of has the image of a wrap skirt, a ruffle skirt. And I loved that so much. And so we made the Dora have their leather calfskins and we decorated the edges in the same way, you know, with rings and studs. They wore neck rings and arm rings, same as the Indibele tribe of South Africa. When you see Esther, pictures of Esther Malongo, and she has on, she's a South African painter. She's probably 100 years old, and she's still painting in South Africa, but she wears her tribal costume, and she wears the neck rings. She also wears the blanket, South African blanket, with these bold colors. And when you look at her, it looks like she's fully armored. Like, you cannot penetrate this woman. And I loved that aspect as well, of how this tribal costume could also feel like armor. And, you know, I experienced that with Selma and the Selma marchers when we dressed them. And we layered them underneath their trench coats so that, you know, clothing can be armor. And so back to the Dora, they also had scarification on printed on their costumes. You see it around their chest and their arms, where we actually did the scarification lines, but we gave it a pattern and a print so that it would also, you know, enhance the beauty of that idea. And then we honored the female form. There's a, what I call a harness that travels around the Dora Milaje costume, and we arranged the lines and the leather work so that, you know, it would travel around the bust, it would hug the waist, it would accentuate the hips, it would elongate the female form. And that was our way of, you know, honoring women as opposed to exposing them.
Yes. And that was clear, because they were, the moment you saw the Dora Milaje, you just spoke of power.
Yeah.
So now that you've done all this, you've gotten this award, what is next for you? What do you want to do now that you've kind of gotten the apex of career in terms of the Oscar?
Yeah. I want to do more costume design. I definitely love it. You know, I could do it to the day I die. But I also want to produce. I'd like to produce some really rich stories. I have so many stories in my whole life and my journey and my family. You know, I'd like to address some of those issues, because I think of the same issues we all deal with every day. Just, you know, relationship issues, mental illness, you know, career building, you know, coming to a city alone as a Black female and, you know, striving for greatness. You know, those, there are stories. I have stories, you know, growing up, you know, in a single parent home and watching my mom, you know, who I felt, you know, not many women today want to raise 8 children by themselves and have a job. So
she's a Dora Milaje
like
herself.
Stories. Yeah, she was. Yeah, she still is. And I just, you know, I just feel like I have so many stories in me, and how can I tell them? I can't tell them all the same way. I want to tell some of them as a producer.
So I know people are calling for you to do a clothing line. Is that something you actually want to do?
I'm on the fence about that, because I know, like, what, all that glitters ain't gold. And it's a lot of work to do in the clothing line. It's like 8 seasons in a year. And, you know, I just don't want to be that person on, you know, Overstock.com trying to sell that stuff.
I don't think you would have to. Like, I don't think you would have to be on Overstock. You would you do, if you did do one, would you do a high end one, or would you do one that is mid range?
I fluctuate. You know, most of the time I go, you know what? I want to be the girl for that Walmart shopper. I want to see my stuff on everybody, affordable. On the kids, on the grandma. I want to find something that will fly off the shelves because it's special and it's affordable. And then I go, ooh, but if I could be like Off-White, that would be amazing.
Look, if you can make us more like, if you can make Dora Milaje come to life, I'd buy the whole line. Just,
yeah.
I'd buy the whole line. I'd be like, wait, how much? I will save my coins. Now, I'm always wondering, like, who is your squad? Who did you call first the day after you got your Oscar? Who is the person that you usually go to, or who are the people?
The day after I got my Oscar, I really wanted to talk to my brother, Robert, who was the artist artist who I admired my whole life. He wasn't able to come out to Los Angeles, and I wanted to know what he thought when he saw me get the Oscar. And so he was the person in my heart that I wanted to know, you know, was there, right there with me, cheering me on.
That is. And who are your girls?
Oh, my girls, they was all there. Let's see. That's Robbie and Cassandra and, my girls and my nieces. Everybody was at my house, like, celebrating and waiting for me to come back. And I went to two parties, so I didn't get here until, like, 2 in the morning. But they were still up drinking and partying in my house. They were like, yeah, your house is great for a party. We walked up, and people were in the living room still, and all the lights were on and laughing. And so then I walked in with the Oscar, and everybody wanted to take a picture with it. Everybody wanted to hold it. So the party started all over again at 2 a.m., but I was tired. I had been through a whole day starting at like 7 a.m. with hair and makeup.
Ooh, 7 a.m.?
Yes. Yeah, I had to be on the red carpet by 2.
Oh, my God. That is a long day. So you probably like, get that out of my house, y'all. Long.
And, you know, I was like, I'm happy as you guys are, but I am tired.
You know, I would have just gone to bed and let them keep the party going.
You know, I had a little bit of an energy, you know, based on that win. You know, there was definitely a feeling of triumph and joy.
And then you started a really cool thing for Women's History Month. That's really blown up on social media. I just got tagged to it twice today, so I got to do my own.
Oh, my God.
And it's been on Entertainment Tonight. It is your Women Dancing Together contest, where you're asking women to tag a friend in a song where they lip sync or sing so they can virtually sing together and essentially unite.
Sing and dance together.
And dance together. And so far, Gabrielle Union, Tracee Ellis Ross, Halle Berry, Tasha Smith, Angela Bassett, the list is growing. What inspired you to do that challenge?
Well, I wanted to do something for Women's History Month. I didn't want the month to pass before I did something. And then, I was just talking to a friend, and, you know, we were just, like, laughing about, you know, how when, you know, they play the song for, you know, like, Electric Side or any of those group dances, you know, all the women who've been wanting to dance all night long, they get up and they dance together. And we were just laughing about that, you know, how that has just been the way that we can, you know, unify. And, you know, even though some of us don't have a partner or don't have, you know, a man in our lives, or, you know, the cute guy in the room ain't asking us to dance, and we've been sitting there for hours, as soon as they play that song, that all of us can get up and dance together, we all get up.
Yes.
And it felt like, as we were talking with it, it felt like that's how women, you know, commune and support. Let's do that as a challenge. Let's talk about unity. Let's talk about supporting each other. You know, let's talk about, you know, being beautiful, being whatever your empowerment song is, and dance, and we can all dance together. We can all have that unified dance.
Yes. I'm excited. So I got to figure out what song I'm going to do. I'm going to do my video today, because today,
awesome.
I'm going to make it happen. I'll be like, yes, I'm doing the Ruth Carter challenge. So
nice.
I recently saw you
at the hashtag women dancing together.
Hashtag women dancing together. So if you listen to this, do this challenge 5 of your friends and dance and sing. I recently saw you at BET Leading Women Defined, and I asked you a question that I'm going to ask you again here, which is, when you are not in the room, what do you want people to say about you?
I like her.
Mm.
You know, we all want to be liked, you know, and you realize that not everybody's going to like you. But I hope that something that I've done or something that I've said or, you know, meant something to someone, that when I left the room, they said, I like her.
That's on point. And I always ask my guests, when you are world dominating and costume designing and doing all this thing and following your passion, how are you taking care of yourself?
Yeah, it's tough. Ooh, it's tough. You know, time ticks by and you realize, you know, 3 years have passed and you haven't taken a vacation, or, you know, a month has passed and you haven't started that diet you wanted to start. And, you know, taking care of yourself is work. And usually when I'm doing it the best, I'm not working because yes. I have to focus on it. I got to prepare my food the night before. And, you know, I'm on all kinds of programs. I got the Peloton and I got
to figure out
which classes I'm going to take, you know. But in general, I feel like if I lead my life with a positive spirit and I remind myself, you know, not to get into degrading people or gossip, because I think those are the things, you know, when you can't take as good of yourself as you would like to with nutrition and exercise, that when you add, you know, the toxic mental things, it makes it worse. So on a daily basis, I have affirmations and I try to stay positive about people. I learned from my mom to stay on the positive side of things. When you see a person, you know, think of them in a positive light as opposed to a negative one. And that, I feel, kind of grounds me, you know, even in my relationships with, you know, my guy. You know, I really want to stay energized by the support that I can give to others.
Yes. And the young Ruth that went to be a dermatologist, are you still into skincare?
No, but I do, you know, my routine, but I loved it as a kid. I loved it because those magazines told you, you know, step by step and all that stuff. So I just loved it. So, I mean, I still, you know, do the routines that you're supposed to do, you know, take off your makeup before you go to bed and mm-hmm. all that good stuff.
I've seen your skin up close. Your skin is bomb. So give us some secrets. What are you doing? What products are you using? We love to know that here.
Yeah, no, I discovered that Farm Fresh product. It's amazing.
What's that one?
It's all natural, farm to farm.
Farm to farm, okay.
Let me look at it right now, because it is awesome, off the chain.
Are you using the whole line?
Smells good, feels good. They have a whole line of products that they put out. It's called Farmhouse Fresh.
Farmhouse Fresh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you're using the face wash and everything?
Face wash, lotion, mousse, you know, everything. I have a whole product line.
Do you exfoliate also weekly? What are you doing with that?
I exfoliate, you know, weekly here. I love exfoliating, though. I have tubes in the shower and, you know, I might be doing it 3 times a week, but I know.
Because I was like, oh no, Ruth's skin is popping, so I need to know. I always try to collect all the skincare secrets because I'm like, what do I need to be doing to make sure my black does not crack?
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, no, I keep something in the shower, you know, something that smells good and has some exfoliating in the shower for my body and my face.
And then after a big project, do you go away for a couple of months or do you go jump
I
right
should.
Into something?
I always say I'm gonna. But I'm always going away on projects and shooting in other states. So staying home is like, staycation is like a really great vacation. You know, you just have, on a staycation, you can't answer the phone. So, because then people want to put you back to work. Wow. And so then I'll take little jaunts to Mexico. Mm-hmm. I have a favorite place there. It's Pueblo Bonito. Pueblo Bonita Pacifica.
Mm.
And it's a holistic spa and retreat. And you can go there for the weekend and they, you know, give you massages on the beach and you do yoga in the morning and it's a beautiful, beautiful place.
Well, that's helpful to know. I'm a great fan of vacations and just tapping out of life sometimes.
Yeah. But
I am really excited for your existence, actually. I think you have consistently done great work over these decades, and you deserve all the awards and all the props and all the accolades. So thank you so much for just being a great person.
Thank you, and thanks for a lovely talk and a lovely interview. I appreciated your question at Limit Women Leading Define.
Yes.
And, you know, good luck to you in the future, and thank you for this time.
Thank you for being on Rants. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.
Shout out to Ruth Carter for joining me. She's amazing. Please follow her on social media. Show her some love there. She is at The Real Ruth E. Carter on Instagram. That's The Real Ruth E. Carter. And then she is I Am Ruth E. Carter on Twitter. What I want y'all to do, if you love these gems that she's dropping, go send her some comments and some love. Tell her you listen to Rants and Randomness and you appreciate her time. Our guests love when you do that, so please continue to do that. Much love to Chicago Recording Company for partnering with me on this podcast. And as always, subscribe to Rants and Randomness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get it. And please share it. Share it on social. Let people know you're listening to this podcast and they should listen too. That makes a big difference. Leave a review. I might feature it on the show. And as always, you can follow me on social media. I am at Lovey. And the podcast is at Rants Randomness on Twitter, on Instagram at Rants and Randomness. See you on the next episode.